Marsh. There are many historic milestones in Harry Truman's presidency, but one of the most impressive was the scrappy Missourian's election in 1948. No one believed he could defeat Republican Thomas Dewey. Pollsters even stopped bothering to canvass weeks before that election. But during the final months of the campaign, Truman took his political crusade to the nation in a 31,000-mile whistle-stop train campaign in which he delivered more than 350 speeches. Against enormous odds, he won. The story of that final effort is told in the book Whistle Stop by Philip White. Philip White joins us by phone now from Colorado. So nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much.
I would like you, if you would, to kind of set the table for us. President Truman's back was against the wall, but what was his political position in 1948?
Yeah, it was very precarious, actually. He had really set out his stall by this point for civil rights, and up until this time, the Democratic Party had kind of referred to southern states as the Solid South, as they believed that that was, as the name was, you know, kind of... imply a really solid voting block for them. But when he really came out with the results of this Civil Rights Commission and just said, you know, this is completely unacceptable, this is going on in our country, and part of this was him having served with men of color in World War One, you know, and his really strong belief that despite being from Missouri, obviously with its history of the border war and all that kind of conflict back in the day, that, you know, the freedoms that applied to white Americans should apply to all Americans. And basically, he alienated this massively powerful southern voting bloc, and that alone threw his presidency into jeopardy. And then also around this time, you have Henry Wallace, who Truman had fired very unceremoniously and quite tactlessly, frankly, sometime before, leading the progressives leftward and really just coming out with some crazy statements about how, you know, continued tension with Russia was really the fault of the Truman administration and, you know, sympathizing with Russia. And then this was also threatening to undermine some of the big union support and pull yet money, even more money away. And you had just seen the Republicans gain a lot of seats in the midterm elections. And really, Harry Truman's approval rating was just in the toilet, frankly, at this point. And so he had a double split in his party coming up with the Dixiecrats and the Henry Wallace's, as he called it, Gideon's Army, the progressives. And then you also have, eventually, as it starts to shape up and the Republicans make their nomination, Thomas Dewey, who, while he had lost to FDR back when Truman was on the ticket as vice president, he had come far, far closer than any other opposing candidate to defeating FDR. And really, the newspapers and magazines at the time were overwhelmingly in favor of Dewey, and over 70% believed that, in fact, Thomas Dewey would win and that Truman wouldn't just lose, but would lose in a landslide. So, and then abroad, you have the Berlin blockade. The Soviets decide they don't like the fact that Berlin is trying to get their own currency, at least in the Allied zones. And so they respond by cutting off all river, road, and rail traffic between their occupied zone and the Allies' occupied zones. And, you know, the millions of pounds of food were needed a day, obviously. And also the Russians controlled a lot of the coal production. And so Truman not only has his double split in his party at home, a very strong Republican challenger, but also tension with Russia is really starting to kick off. And so he's got a lot of problems.
He certainly had his hands full. We should mention that the Dixiecrat, the Southern candidate, was Strom Thurmond, whose name has popped up in the news more recently, given what's been going on in the South these days.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that necessitated Mr. Truman and friends having to be somewhat innovative in the way they approached the campaign. Down by a ton, what did they do?
So really what they decided is that although Harry Truman had been much maligned as a public speaker, and he was not very good, and they had tried everything. They had tried cue cards. They had tried writing out word-for-word speeches, and nothing was really working. He was just taken on his own merit or lack thereof. He was not a very good public speaker. and you can pair him to the silky tones of FDR, or indeed by this time Winston Churchill's speeches were widely rebroadcast across the United States. And so you had, two of the great political orators of the age on both sides of the Atlantic kind of bookending this guy from Missouri in the middle. And it just wasn't working. And so eventually they figured out, he can do this. We can make him a better speaker if he's speaking to smaller audiences. And he was a great conversationalist in one-on-one situations and to small groups, and a wonderful storyteller. And so really Clark Clifford, obviously a St. Louis connection there, a Missouri connection, and his publicity guy, who was also another, actually ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize, I believe, for his journalism work, Charlie Ross, they just decided, look, we need to get him in front of as many people as possible. And the best way to do this is to do this whistle stop tour, and so we're gonna kind of test it out and work out the kinks in June. We'll send him out west for about 9,000 miles, and then if it works, we're gonna do another 22,000 miles in September and October, and we're just gonna try to get him in front of people at what ended up being 352 stops, and let him tell his story about why his platform is different, why people should give a darn about civil rights, and some of the other programs, low-cost housing being one, supporting continued farming subsidies, obviously being a big one in the Midwest. And if we can just get him in front of these and free him from this Roosevelt mold we've tried to jam him into and stop writing these flowery speeches, then just maybe we can turn this thing around.
A lot of his speech-making was off the cuff, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, exactly. And so really another difference maker, as you'll see in the book, was I found that there were these several young men who were drafted in to become a research division for Harry Truman this year. And this was really, the Republicans had something similar, but it wasn't very well organized. And so, to try and gain an edge, they pulled in these guys. And they were, experts in public policy, some of them. Some of them were journalists. Actually, one had cut his teeth at the Kansas City Star, so another Midwest connection there. And they were charged with both doing kind of big policy speech research on all the major domestic and foreign issues, but also finding local tidbits of information that on each of those 352 stops, and they really relied on the Works Progress Administration guides to all these towns and also local newspapers, and just really worked around the clock. And so what they would do is they would come up with working no more than 2 days in advance, just due to the sheer workload. They would come up with localized information that Truman could use. If there had been a flood in a certain town, well, he wanted to know that. If there was a baseball star in this town, maybe he could mention him, and really just use this as an introduction for the 5 or 10 or 20 minute speech he would give from the back of the train, and then he'd briefly read over the talking points to the next whistle stop, and then he'd try committing to memory and go out and use that, and then bash the do nothing Congress as he told it. But really those little local tidbits, it was almost like having a pre-internet in terms of being able to do local searches. And I was lucky enough to track down the son of Johannes Hover, who was a German immigrant who had escaped the Nazis. And luckily his son Frank was really the de facto family historian. I tracked him down through his blog, and he sent me all manner of information, even down to tax returns, and how much his father had budgeted for cigarettes and this type of thing during the campaign. And just able to get hold of this treasure trove of information that really enabled me to tell the story of these 7 extraordinary young men who's really were putting bullets in the gun in terms of ammunition for Truman's campaign.
Of course, what they were doing is what we take for granted today. I mean, but this was a real innovation for the time. You said the Dewey's people were doing it, but not effectively.
Yeah, exactly. And it was only a recent thing. It had been the previous campaign, and it had, helped Dewey get within, I believe, and someone's going to call in and say I'm wrong on this figure, I think it was only 3 million votes in the popular vote separating Dewey and FDR, you know, back in 44. And so it was just another way that Clark Clifford and these other guys running the Truman campaign were able to give themselves an edge. And frankly, they had no idea whether it would work. But hey, you know, we'll pay seven guys who are passionate about their subject areas. You know, we'll pay them a little bit. It wasn't a great salary, and we'll work them half to death, and we'll see what comes out the other end. And what ended up coming out was obviously Truman was able to not only be himself, but also talk to people in language they understood and connect with them on local issues that meant something to them, and not just give the kind of stock speech that Thomas Dewey read at each and every stop he made.
Well, Dewey was really on cruise control, as I take it from your book, because the odds were so overwhelmingly in his favor that he really didn't have to work very hard, and that was costly.
Yeah, absolutely. That is exactly the case, Don. He made less than half. It was between a third and a half of the total number of speeches that Truman made. Harry Truman once gave 16 speeches in a day. I believe that actually happened twice. And a couple of times it was so late at night that he kind of forgot that he had committed to speak somewhere else, and he came out in his pajamas because he was too exhausted to change. And, you know, the media, of course, had a field day, at least those that were anti-Truman at the time, and said it was very unpresidential, you know, and this would never have happened during FDR's time. But Truman didn't care because there were 9 or 10 people that turned out this tiny little town, I believe it was in Iowa, and he had said he was going to speak there, and he couldn't really be bothered to get changed back into a suit, so he came out in his pajamas and gave him 5 or 6 minutes of amusing rhetoric and hopped back on the train, went to sleep, and got up at 6 the next morning and repeated it.
His stamina was incredible. It's very clear from your book. I mean, and as you've just indicated, early morning, late at night, he was going full speed all day long.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really an incredible feat.
Is there any indication as to how many people he spoke to directly during this whistle stop campaign?
Yeah, it's really hard to put numbers around it. I mean, the Truman campaign said that it was several million people, because he, in addition to, you know, like I said, speaking to a handful of a kind of two horse town or even a one horse town, over and over, he did give the commencement address out at a big university in California that kind of kicked off the campaign, and also gave them an excuse, frankly, to call this a non-political tour, the June leg of the campaign, which it was very political, in fact, and was completely aimed towards his re-election. But and then there were several other huge engagements as well, where, you know, it was 50, 60, 80,000 people. But yeah, so nobody's really put a number on it. I think the campaign said, you know, between 2 and 3 million people, but who knows whether that's accurate or not.
We can almost count on the fact they probably exaggerated that number.
I would imagine. I mean, the 352 stops total is completely legitimate.
Sure.
It's very well documented on the Truman Library's excellent website.
I have to take a break now. We're talking with Philip White. He's the author of Whistle Stop, subtitled How 31,000 Miles of Train Travel, 352 Speeches, and a Little Midwest Gumption Saved the Presidency of Harry Truman. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Philip White, the author of Whistle Stop. Philip, one of the things that struck me, it's so unlike the way things work today, was the fact that Mr. Truman actually had to pay radio networks to carry his speeches during the campaign.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And one of my favorite stories from the book, and quite extraordinary once I started digging into it and all the various records that again, I got from the wonderful Harry Truman Library in Independence, Missouri. It's a plug for them. They're paying me to say this. No, they're not. But it is a wonderful research room and library and museum there. And spent many days digging through the archives. And what I found is that they were in a real bind, and they were also kind of short-staffed on the campaign. So this gentleman, who was actually Oscar Chapman, who was Undersecretary of the Interior, so that you wouldn't imagine that he'd be doing these weird campaign things, but he ended up having to. He was charged with finding money for the initial kind of big address on Labor Day. You know, Truman was very worried about losing the Labor vote to Henry Wallace and the Progressives. And obviously later, the full extent of how deeply those two, you know, the labor organizations and at least some of them and Henry Wallace's group, you know, that really came to light a long time afterwards. But anyway, so Chapman calls up Oklahoma Governor Roy Turner, who had met Truman a couple of times and was a well-known Truman supporter. And he says, Governor, you know, I'm in a big bind here. If I don't get $50,000 to the radio networks by midnight, they are not going to cover 1 minute of the president's speech. So Turner, you know, kind of sucks on his teeth a little bit, you know. Man, I don't know about this. And this is a guy who, as well as being governor, made his money cattle ranching. You know, imagine that down in Oklahoma. It's not even a stereotype, is it, much? But anyway, so he had a bit of money, and he had a lot of rich friends, rich backers. And so he says, Oscar, give me a couple hours. I'll call you back. And so time ticks on, and Chapman's sitting beside the phone in the Detroit hotel just sweating bullets. You know, an hour goes by, a couple hours go, and he's starting to think, man, is Turner, is he going to leave me hanging? Like, what is he doing? And so eventually Turner calls him back, and he says, you know, Oscar, I have the money, and I'm taking this check down to the local affiliate, and you tell those SOBs at the main station, if they don't run that, you know, that speech in its fullest, I'm going to come up there and burn the whole station to the ground. And so he is, you know, you can imagine Turner is, it seems like quite a colorful character. And, so really they ran this speech, but then the network still apparently hadn't had enough money and ended up cutting off the end of the speech. And so Harry Truman gets up on a chair in the Red Room at the White House in a fundraiser and begs for money. And there are a few journalists there, Joseph Alsop, who I believe had a family tie to the Roosevelts, you know, just lampooned him the next day and said again, this was before the pajama speech incident, but how undignified, you know, this would never have happened in FDR's time. And and Truman gets up on this chair and he says, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I'm asking for your help. You know, we don't have enough money to get the train down the line. And frankly, just begged for money. And later in the campaign, again, Roy Turner had to come to his rescue in Oklahoma City, because the railroad had got wind that the campaign was short of cash. They said, sorry, we've got to cover expenses. We're not sending this train down the line. The whistle stop, you know, tour can't continue till we have our money. And luckily, Roy Turner was on the platform. So he goes to his rich friends who were gathered there. They'd been at the Oklahoma State Fairgrounds, the Truman speech earlier in the day, and says, gentlemen, you know, would you like to do a meet and greet with the president? Oh, yeah, that would be great. And, oh, by the way, we're going to pass the hat round afterwards, you know, and collect some more cash. And they managed to get enough, and they paid the railroad, and they went on down the line. So several things pop out to me here. Can you imagine, in this day and age, a presidential speech being cut off? Can you imagine a sitting president having to not sit but stand on a chair in a White House fundraiser and beg for money? And, you know, third, can you imagine a railroad saying, yeah, we don't think you're good for this money. You know, it's not enough that you say you're going to pay us later. We need this money or the president can't go on down the line. I just cannot fathom that happening. Today's super PACs and everything. But, yeah, this all happened, and it's right there in the source notes. It's verified, and it's incredible to me.
How much help were Bess Truman and the daughter Margaret? They were with him virtually right at all of these stops, I guess.
Yeah, and it's funny because his wife Bess, you know, was not Eleanor Roosevelt. She didn't enjoy being first lady. She didn't want to use it really to make any social changes. She, as soon as Truman went to Washington as a senator, she pretty much hightailed it back to Missouri and just didn't really enjoy being in the nation's capital. She, you know, preferred to be back home in small-town Independence with her friends and family and didn't like it. Now, Margaret, on the other hand, was an aspiring singer and really loved attention, and she would come out on the back platform and she would throw roses and other flowers down to crowds and blow kisses to them, and I think she she enjoyed it even more than old Harry did. So quite a studying contrast there. So, yeah, I think Margaret was there for more of these stops than the First Lady was, but it was probably quite a help. But, yeah, Bess Truman was among those who thought that her husband was going to be not just beaten, but soundly beaten.
I guess this was years before the president threatened a critic of Margaret's singing, said, "You better buy a beefsteak for your
right,
eye
exactly,
after I get
exactly,
through with you."
Yeah, because I'm going to give you a black eye. That's right, yeah.
Really. What about stumbles? I mean, obviously this campaign was successful. The famous picture, Dewey defeats Truman, taken, by the way, at Union Station here in St. Louis.
Yeah.
But there were some stumbles along the way that could have been costly.
Yeah, absolutely. He only mentioned Thomas Dewey by name twice during the campaign, because this was a day and age where, at least in theory, there was a little more dignity and people didn't get down in the mud too much. And really, he just went to war on the 80th Congress, which, as we know, one of the most famous political phrases, the do-nothing Congress, and just took them to task instead of Dewey. But one time where he at least inferred Dewey's name without mentioning it, he said, you know, we all know what happened in Germany when they got, you know, a fanatical candidate. Well, how did that work out for them? You know, that kind of thing. And really made this crazy Hitler connection to Thomas Dewey, who was, quite frankly, a moderate. And if you know anything about Dewey, you'll know that he had quite a reputation as a reformer and tackling a lot of organized crime stuff up there in New York before he ran for president, and really was, you know, not very far from Truman on a lot of the issues. So to compare him to Hitler, even though he didn't say it in so many words, was quite frankly outrageous. So that was a major stumble. And then early in this June tour, as they called it, the inspection tour, non-political, you know, as they said it was, which it was not, the organization was somewhat lacking. And Truman ended up speaking in Nebraska to what was meant to be a jam-packed stadium, and it was less than a third full. And obviously those two-thirds of newspapers and news magazines that were against Truman published photos of all these empty seats and just went to town on this thing, you know, and said, oh, well, this just shows, you know, Truman has no chance. And Elmo Roper, who was running the Roper poll, the second biggest poll at the time behind Gallup, was so convinced by this type of thing that, you know, it was just evidence of the bumbling of the Truman campaign and that he had no shot in come November, come the polling day, that he actually stopped polling almost two full months before the election, if you can believe that. So early in September, he had a nationally syndicated column in the newspapers, and he explained that it would take a miracle for Harry Truman to come back and win.
Which is exactly what happened. You know, one of the things that also struck me, Philip White, about the book and the time is the fact that there are so many striking parallels between 1948 and the Truman campaign and what's going on today. I mean, some of the things that were on the table were immigration, minimum wage discussion, civil rights, use of executive orders, the Fair Deal, which encompassed a national health insurance plan. I mean, these are all things we're talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another one that I find interesting is education, you know, and we can't figure this thing out with regard to inner city education and education for the poor particularly, and also federal funding for education. And obviously in Kansas with some of the recent cuts, you know, I used to live in the suburb of Olathe, and I heard recently, and I don't know as this is hearsay, and I've been hunkering down on research for this book project, so forgive me if I speak incorrectly, but that the Olathe school board was told that they had to cut $2 million, you know, and this is a top-ranking school district out there in the suburb of Kansas City, and I'm not sure how you're going to continue to be top-ranking if your governor and your legislature are going after something that I believe should be ring-fenced and protected in education funding. So, yeah, I mean, some of these things, again, today, and like you said, obviously civil rights at this time is in no way comparable to what it is today. But there was obviously a lot of work to be done there, and I honestly do believe that if Harry Truman had had enough backing to pass what, you know, the two acts that LBJ ended up passing quite a few years later, obviously, that he would have done so. And this is reflected in some of the private correspondence that I air and bring to light in the book, and that David McCullough and his wonderful Truman book and others have brought to light, that Harry Truman was a very principled man and made a very principled stand on the platform, the very shaky platform of civil rights. And I say shaky because we saw what happened in the voting in the South, and that Strom Thurmond was able to gain a foothold. And, yeah, Truman was, I mean, this could have cost him the election, but he didn't care because he believed that in civil rights and that it was the chief issue in the country at the time and that something had to be done. And so just on principle, he put principle before political pragmatism, if you can indulge all those P's, and really made his stand, even though he knew that the South was going to go to heck and he was going to lose most of the South.
We're going to have to leave it at that, Philip White. Once again, the book is Whistle Stop. A lot of fascinating information in it. I would recommend it. I enjoyed it thoroughly and enjoyed talking to you, too. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah, wonderful to talk to you again, and hope we can do it again soon with the next one.
I hope we can. Hope we can. Thank you, Philip White. When we come back, we'll take a closer look at the Truman presidency saved by that 1948 campaign. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. In some ways, Harry Truman was an accident of history. As you heard earlier, he won an election he was not supposed to win. Before that, he was a little-known senator when Franklin Roosevelt chose him as his running mate in 1944. Roosevelt's sudden death catapulted the feisty Missourian into the White House to face monumental wartime and post-war crises. Joining me in studio to help put the Truman presidency into perspective is Peter Kester, history professor at Washington University. By phone, we're joined by Sam Ruscha, supervisory archivist at the Truman Library and Museum in Independence. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Peter, I'll start with you, if I may. Was Harry Truman underappreciated as a president, do you think?
Well, historians certainly think so, because when historians and political scientists and people who evaluate presidents now look at Truman, they see him as – they see his presidency as an impressive presidency, less so on domestic policy but much more on foreign policy and his role as a leader. But yeah, when he left office – you know, there were, in fact, early approval rating polls at that time, and he had very low approval ratings, and he felt like the American public really didn't like him and didn't appreciate what he had done. And over time, people have been increasingly complimentary toward Truman's presidency.
Sam, I'll bet you see that and take note of that in your job there at the library in Independence.
We certainly do, Mr. Marsh. I would like to, you know, reiterate what Mr. Kester said. There were a couple factors involved, and many of the problems that Truman faced leaving office and in the last year or two of his presidency had to do with the public dissatisfaction over the pace of the Korean War, over allegations that there were communists in the government, and that there was corruption in the Truman administration. But over time, you know, Truman's stature certainly has increased, and there's reasons for that as well.
Sam, if you would please call me Don, I would appreciate it.
Okay. Don, I will.
And I'm not speak for Peter, but I bet you'd prefer to be called Peter,
very much.
Peter as well.
Okay,
thank you for that. You know, Peter, the enormity of the crises that he had to face. I mean, starting with the decision to use the bomb, then you've got the Cold War, and you've got the Berlin Airlift and the Marshall Plan, then Korea, and you can go on and on with the crises that he was facing.
Absolutely. Every president who inherits the presidency is always blindsided by it. It's never expected. And one of the real questions is, how does a president, a new president who'd been vice president, respond to that? And that's part of why people have said Truman was successful, as he faced all of this at once. He faced enormously important decisions. And in the long run, the decisions he made seem to have been prudent ones, and you listed some of them there. Mm-hmm. He also desegregated the military. He recognized the state of Israel. He responded to a complete transformation in the way labor and industrial labor worked in the United States. He was dealing with a post-war economy. It's hard to think of another president who inherited the office, who faced many challenges as he did. The only one I can think of is Andrew Johnson after Lincoln's assassination, and he never really became an effective president. Truman managed to rise to the challenge, and that's in fact what a lot of people. That's the biggest compliment people have for him, is this is a guy who was not prepared to be president. FDR certainly hadn't prepared him. Suddenly he becomes president and he faces all these challenges and rises to the occasion.
Why did FDR choose him?
For several reasons. First of all, he simply wanted to evict John Ants Garner, who had been his vice president. He needed somebody. First of all, he wanted somebody who wasn't going to challenge his authority. And that's certainly the way he perceived Truman. Truman also bolstered the selection of Truman solidified FDR's strength within certain constituencies in the Democratic Party. But it seems like an afterthought to FDR going into the 1944 election, even though he was gravely ill. And he knew that. He didn't, of course, know just how ill he was, but he certainly wasn't thinking that he was selecting a successor.
Yeah. So, I think that's
go ahead,
very
Sam.
True. Oh, if you don't mind, Don, yes. Just to build upon what Peter said, Truman had a lot of good qualifications that he brought to the table, including that he was a political moderate from a border state. He had made quite a name for himself chairing a Senate committee while Harry Truman was United States Senator from Missouri. A committee to investigate the National Defense Program, and made the cover of Time magazine. You know, he was certainly not a household name by any stretch, but in political circles, and particularly in the Democratic Party and the powers of the Democratic Party, Truman was well positioned to take over the mantle of vice president.
But he carried some baggage, and that from his days in Kansas City with the Prendergast crowd.
He certainly did. That's quite right, Don. He did have that baggage, and when he first arrived in the Senate in 1935, some considered him the senator from Prendergast as opposed to the senator from Missouri. But as a result of his hard work and his integrity, he quickly made a name for himself and gained respect of his fellow senators, and rose to prominence.
Peter, did you want to react to the Prendergast part of the story?
No. I think Sam got it absolutely right. That was whether the corruption was real or not, that was certainly a criticism that many people had of him.
One of the things that I've heard people comment upon is the fact that, the Brits turned on Winston Churchill after the war and the role that he played, significant role he played during that wartime period. And that the people sort of turned on Harry Truman after the war, too. I mean, his popularity was down. Do you see – is that analogous in any way in your mind?
There's some analogy to it. The move against Churchill came much sooner. Yeah. For Truman, came later in his first term, and a lot of it tied to some real domestic economic issues, concerns about inflation, about labor strife. Also, as Sam was saying, the accusations that he was not sufficiently aggressive in pursuing suspected communists within the federal government. So it didn't happen immediately, and it's partly about the end of the war. But and Sam can speak to this as well. My sense is. It's not just about the end of the war, but it's about the changing American political landscape.
Sam?
I think that's very true. I think that's true. Truman did enjoy a honeymoon period, mm-hmm. When he took office in April of 1945 upon the sudden death of Franklin Roosevelt. Many people did not know who could not name the vice president, Harry Truman, when he took office. But people were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. Because the war was still ongoing, particularly against Japan, and there were numerous, as Peter mentioned, economic issues and problems of economic reconversion, the 12 million American servicemen and women that were coming back from overseas, they needed jobs, they needed homes, they needed education, and the American public was willing to grant Truman a period of time to adjust to all these huge problems. But Truman's popularity was sustained enough, at least through the 1948 election, so that he could get reelected in 1948 successfully. But he certainly had bumps along the way with the labor unrest and the inflation that Peter mentioned. And then the second term, you know, I think Korea was the main thing that really kind of derailed Truman's presidency. The firing of Douglas MacArthur in April 1951 was a highly unpopular decision, at least initially. But over time, the American public seemed to understand the reasoning that Truman brought. But Truman had a tremendous number of challenges and difficulties that he had to face.
I remember very clearly, old soldiers never die. They just fade away. The final words, the public life of Douglas MacArthur.
Exactly. Hero of World War II, immensely popular, a one-time presidential candidate himself. But Truman was determined to assert the primacy of the civilian control of the military. To Truman, it was a constitutional issue, and to have Douglas MacArthur, you know, make comments to the press about how he would prefer to conduct the Korean War, Truman could not let that stand. Although he did give MacArthur several opportunities, you know, to continue on until it was impossible to do so.
Peter, it really is reflective of his personality. I mean, he was a no-nonsense guy, and he was almost fearless, it seems to me, when it came to making decisions that were tough, and MacArthur being one of them.
Yeah, that was a very tough decision, but it took him a while to get to that point. What's really striking to me, but makes perfect sense, is in 45, 46, 40, even in 47, there are certain areas where there's this real scramble within the administration to know what to do. And as Truman's learning the job, it takes him a while to make a number of these assertive decisions. They start in 48, the Berlin airlift, the sort of true implementation of reconstruction in Europe, the recognition of Israel, desegregation of the military. They all happen then, but that's 3 years after he's in office. And before that, there are a lot of people within the cabinet, the sub-cabinet, the various federal agencies who some of them think they should be in charge and they should, you know, since they've been in those offices, they should be able to continue to make decisions. Others are really arguing with each other and trying to get Truman's approval. And it really took him quite a while to get a handle on all this stuff, as it would for anyone taking charge of the country.
Sam, would you think that, we can go down the long list and have to some degree already of some of the things that were happening during his campaign or during his presidency, but do you think the decision on the atomic bomb, using that, was perhaps the most important decision he made?
Oh, you mean during his entire presidency?
Yeah.
It was certainly a very important one. There was no doubt about that, and it's one that ended the war against Japan, and it was one that introduced the world to the atomic age. You can make an argument that was his most important. Although, you know, in Truman's mind, it was really almost a no-brainer in the sense that he was shortly after taking office in April of 1945, he was briefed about this bomb project, about which he knew a little bit as United States Senator, and FDR had given him a little brief information about it. But for Truman, it really was a military weapon that he believed would end the war and save American lives. And to him, he was willing to use whatever, you know, weapon or means at his disposal to do so. Yeah, it was a very important decision, yes, but there were, you know, many others that we've discussed, you know, that had long-lasting effect in terms of relief to Europe after World War II, for example.
The Marshall Plan.
Yeah, exactly, the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, the creation of the National Security Establishment that we still, you know, have to this day. I think there's kind of a tendency sometimes to reduce the Truman presidency to, you know, the bomb, so to speak, you know, in his decision there. But looking over the entire fabric of Truman's presidency and the many numerous decisions that have had long-lasting impact, not to mention the conduct of the Cold War for 40 years, you know, I think it has to be placed within context.
What do you think, Peter?
I absolutely agree. And the dropping the bomb was, in some ways, the decision with the biggest immediate impact upon individual people. But the long-term impact, which is directly from that, is from the Cold War establishment. When Truman became president, the U.S. had a military and diplomatic structure that was really shaped by World War II. By the time he left, the system was in place that would built on the aggressive containment of the Soviet Union and of communism in general that would really be in place for 40 years. And if we think about it, the other institutions created while he's president are the CIA, the Unified Defense Department, this much larger national security apparatus. And that goes a long way towards how people have talked about Truman, that critics of Truman and the Truman administration would talk periodically about all the issues we've discussed. Did he manage domestic challenges well? Was he corrupt? But also, was he too aggressive? There are some critics who would say he exacerbated the Cold War through such direct confrontation with the Soviet Union. There are others who say he made prudent decisions by creating a structure that would respond to a legitimate threat posed by the Soviet Union.
For the benefit of the audience who don't know, the Truman Doctrine is what?
Sam, you want to take – I mean, you guys study the most.
Oh, sure. Sure. I'd be happy to. That was a policy that President Truman established in 1947. It was a speech that he gave to Congress, and it specifically addressed a leftist or communist insurgency in Greece. But it had a broader framework. In other words, President Truman said is that it would be the policy of the United States to resist attempted subjugation by armed minorities or outside pressures. And what he meant by that, he didn't even mention the word Soviet Union there. But the Soviet Union, who had been our wartime ally during World War II, was becoming quickly our adversary. And Truman realized that a lot of the unrest that the Greeks were seeing, and in Turkey as well, was as a result of pressure from the Soviet Union. So the Truman Doctrine really formed the framework, the ideological framework, for what would be the United States policy for the next 40 years, which is that the United States, whenever possible, would identify areas where the Soviet Union was seen to be trying to stir unrest and impose communism, and that the United States would provide aid, either economic or military, to those countries that were our friends.
And of course, on the horizon was McCarthyism, which I guess began to flourish just as his presidency was ending. But that was another aspect of the anti-communist flavor at that particular time. Peter,
yes.
How well do you think Harry Truman stood up to Joseph Stalin? They met a few times. Do you have any sense that, could they go toe-to-toe?
That's a loaded question. It's because – and that's actually the biggest challenge, that his critics said the Cold War is a boxing match like that. And so the question isn't simply how did he deal with Stalin individually, because at the end of the day, no one could really deal with Stalin individually. The real question that people have asked is how did Truman respond to Stalin, to the Soviet Union institutionally? Did he build a sufficient institutional apparatus to respond to that? Or if you put it the other way, there are many – we've been mentioning how he faced criticism from from McCarthy and from others who are claiming that he was too soft on communism. But over time, there are people who claimed that creating this – that he overreacted, that he created this vast national security apparatus that in fact it raised the likelihood of a Third World War rather than reducing it. So, if you like Harry Truman, you could say he was in a no-win situation. But what I would say is it really reflects just how unpredictable and precarious the circumstances were in which he was president. And I should add, during a second administration, which he's not even living in the White House. The White House was being gutted and completely reconstructed on the inside. And he's living in this little Blair House, across the street.
And there was an assassination attempt at the Blair House. And I almost forgot, Puerto Rican nationalist, as I recall.
Yeah.
Sam, did you want to elaborate on that? You sounded like you wanted to say something.
Well, I think Peter's absolutely right about that. It's interesting when Stalin and Truman met at Potsdam, which was a conference in Germany in July of 1945, 70 years ago, Truman kind of assessed Stalin as being very smart and as someone he could deal with. He even put kind of saw him in almost like Tom Pendergast. He actually, you know, wrote that, you know, his former political mentor in Kansas City. And, you know, so he did kind of, you know, assess Stalin as someone he could deal with. But, you know, he quickly realized, you know, that Stalin had his own agenda and that did not align, you know, with that of the United States, and that, you know, Stalin wanted to consolidate his power in Eastern Europe. And Peter's right, you know, that critics of Truman see that he overreached in building a national security state. Truman had criticisms on both sides. It was almost a no-win situation in 1948 when he ran for re-election. His critics on the left, such as Henry Wallace, argued that Truman was basically a warmonger who was going to get us into war. Critics on the right thought Truman was too soft on the Soviet Union and too soft on what were seen as communists in government, and that Truman wasn't going far enough.
Our time is beginning to wind down. I want to bring in Maury, a listener who's called in, wants to make a question, has a question or comment. Go ahead, Maury. You're on the air.
Yes, this is Mary.
Oh, Mary.
And I just wanted to say, I heard one of your guests talking about Roosevelt's vice president as being John Nance Garner, which is true for two of Roosevelt's terms, but from 1941 until 1945, he changed, and his Roosevelt's vice president was before Truman with Henry Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, well, I heard him just mention it, but I just went into, because Henry Wallace was very controversial.
Sure, and one of the candidates in opposition in 1940. Mary, thanks very much for the call. Time is winding down, but one of the things that struck me about the time was the fact that the issues that Truman faced politically at home were very much the issues that we're dealing with today with regard to, I mentioned this to our previous guest, immigration, national health insurance, and that sort of thing. It's really a mirror of today, don't you think, Peter?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think your guest earlier was really did a great job of describing how not just the uncanny similarities, but also the just how tough it then as now, how tough it was to respond to those challenges.
Sam, when people come to the library and to the museum, what is it that they seem most interested in?
Well, there's a number of great exhibits that we have here at the library, including one currently going on about the 1945 and then the ending of the war, that momentous year, 1945, 70 years ago this year. That is a big draw. You know, people come for that exhibit. They also come to hear to see our other permanent exhibits here at the library. The library also features, you know, the gravesite of the Trumans here in our courtyard. We also have the Truman's working office exhibit where people can come and actually look into Truman's office where he conducted business and visited with people and wrote mail and answered the phone here at the library in Independence for almost 10 years. From 1957, when the library was established, until the mid-1960s. Visitors can see that. They can experience that. And one of the beauties of working here is that Truman himself spent so much time, you know, talking to researchers here in our research room, going to our auditorium and talking to students there about his big decisions.
Obviously, a great place to visit. Our time is, and I just want to put this to you and to Peter very, very quickly. One of the top five presidents, Peter?
I don't know if I'd call him one of the top five, but he's in the top tier. How's that sound?
It sounds like you're not going to make a commitment on that.
No. Well,
Sam, very quickly from you. Top five?
Yes. Yes. And you might think, well, he's biased. He works at the Truman Library.
Whatever.
Maybe that would be a subject for another conversation. But, yes, I have reasons for believing he does belong in the top five.
Thank you so much for being with us, Sam Boucher. Peter Castor, thank you for being with us. We've got a scoop tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air. We'll look at the growing field of branded entertainment in St. Louis. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/STL on Air. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis is Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.